What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Hi, I'm Larry Rifkin. For those who will be celebrating Christmas, we hope that you'll have a very merry and safe holiday season. I wish you this on behalf of John Krofcik, my partner, and Scott Phillips, who is our social media designer. On today's podcast, we're going to be talking about trade, and we've done a number of podcasts in the recent period with varying opinions about free trade, or what's left of it around the globe. It has been an early casualty of COVID-19. Many countries pretty quickly limited the export of medical supplies, food, and even toilet paper, so much so that trade overall dropped 18%. From the previous year, and foreign direct investment out of borders by 40% worldwide. Now, this comes at the end of a 10-year period in which trade and foreign investment have been stagnant or falling as a share of gross domestic product. That's why we're now calling this period an era of slowbalization. Our guest, Mark Levinson, a former editor of the very prestigious Economist magazine, tells us that globalization is changing, but it is far from dead. In his first book, The Box, he described how shipping containers were key to global trade years back. But now, in his latest book, Outside the Box, he tells us that the world economy is indeed changing. Modern globalization is here to stay. But what and how we are sharing things, stuff, is giving way to ideas and services. Things like banking, engineering, IT, and what is called idea production. And the notion of a country of origin is so much harder to assign today than in the past as our economies become more information and technology based. I mean, guess how many countries Apple has suppliers in? 49. It's pretty amazing. Well, a great topic for our podcast, and I think we have the perfect guest for you today on America Trends.
With me on America Trends is Mark Levinson, and he's written a wonderful new book entitled Outside the Box, How Globalization Changed Moving Stuff to Spreading Ideas. And Mark, you wrote the book that got a lot of attention just a while back, The Box. Now it's Outside the Box. First, take us inside the box to the premise of your first book, and then, in a way, tell us whether Outside the Box is a sequel.
All righty. The Box, which was originally published in 2006 and then published in a revised edition in 2016, is a history of the shipping container, which is about the most mundane and most boring piece of equipment one could imagine. But as I describe, it was an essential part of globalization. The shipping container dramatically reduced the cost of shipping freight and made shipping much more reliable. And those two characteristics made these long international supply chains possible. And so I argue that this really pretty obscure invention had a pretty significant effect on the world economy and on the development of what we now refer to as value chains. Outside the Box takes a look at, it's a history of globalization told very briefly and I hope interestingly and entertainingly, to take us into a changing world. At the time The Box was written, we've been through a period in which international trade was growing twice as fast as the world economy or even more. Many factories in high-wage countries, the United States, Europe, and Japan, had closed up. Production had been placed in lower-wage countries, China, Mexico, other places, with rather dramatic effects on many communities. A lot of people benefited from those shifts. A lot of people were very badly hurt by those shifts. But that was the story of the box. The story of outside the box is really how these supply chains got taken too far. They became increasingly unreliable. They became increasingly slow to the point that it takes longer to get goods delivered today than it did then. And as a result of that, we've seen manufacturers and retailers begin to retreat from these long and complicated value chains. This is something that predated Trump, predated Brexit, predated COVID-19, has been going on for a few years now. And I argue that we're headed into a future in which trade in services is going to matter a whole lot more than trade in the goods and services.
You describe the long tail of different iterations of globalization. What do you think in this modern era that we're now living, what the term really means, how most people interpret the notion of globalization?
Globalization since the late 1980s has really revolved around these long, complex supply chains that cross borders. This was an entirely new phenomenon. International trade has been around for a very long time, but the idea that you would set up a production chain so that this component would be made here and that component would be made there and these components would be shipped to someplace else, perhaps in a different country, to be assembled into something else, which might be shipped again someplace else to be assembled into yet another product, which then would be shipped across the ocean to the end user. That is entirely a development of the late 1980s. And that has really characterized globalization since then. What people, I think, don't realize, though, is that international trade as a share of the world's output peaked back in 2008. Foreign investment as a share of the world's output peaked in 2007. So even as we've been going through all this angst about globalization, and you've got people like, you know, President Trump or politicians like Marine Le Pen in France or similar people in other countries inveighing against globalization, this form of globalization is past its prime. We've seen international trade growing more slowly than the world economy in recent years, not faster. Meanwhile, we've seen all kinds of new possibilities for trading services, and that's really where the action is. And so that's where I think globalization is headed.
Now, you describe a pause in globalization, and the years were 1914 to 1947. I can't help but remind myself that we had two world wars in that period. Is that a coincidence?
Well, not at all. There was a lot of international economic integration, to use a fancy phrase, before World War I. Okay, there was a lot of trade. It was not trade in value chains like we have today. It was mostly trade in commodities, but there was a great deal of it. There was a lot of cross-border investment going on. You had foreign investors with a significant stake in U.S. industry and in Argentine railroads and in all kinds of things in different countries around the world. There was a lot of international lending. So in some ways, the international economy was really quite globalized. All of that came crashing to an end in 1914 with the outbreak of World War I, and it didn't really restart until after World War II. At that point, the emphasis was on lowering tariffs. One of the things that came out of World War II was the creation of what was called the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which was an international organization. And the members held round after round of negotiation to agree to reduce their tariffs and hope that this would spark more international trade. And this did. There were seven successful rounds of tariff negotiations under the GATT. But of course, what happened over time is instead of a few countries at the beginning, there got to be very, very many countries, and it got to be harder and harder to reach these sorts of agreements. The kinds of trade that went on during the GATT were manufactured trade. For the first time, starting in the 1950s, manufactured trade accounted for more of international trade than commodities. But again, this is nothing like today's supply chains. Here the idea was that you would have some kind of product made here and shipped there, or some kind of commodity made here, mined here and shipped there. The idea that you would divide your production process into 100 steps and spread it out all around the world wasn't on. That's really something of the modern era.
Well, in the old days, we used to say made in America or made in the USA, and that was really a sign of quality and such. But today it's really hard to pinpoint the countries that are involved or that have touched the manufacturing process as it relates to so many products.
Well, that's right, and there are two reasons for that. One is that you've got the process of production itself parceled out into many different countries. Typically for a product such as a car or an airplane or even, as we've learned lately, a pharmaceutical, there are several levels of suppliers, and they may be in all different locations and ship partially finished goods from one to another for further processing. So that is a different type of globalization from what we've had before. The other thing that you've got that's part of manufacturing today is that services play a very, very important role in the finished product. And it's almost impossible to figure out where those products, where the services are added, because they can be moved around the globe often very easily. This has to do with the design of the product. This has to do with the marketing of the product. This may have to do with the maintenance of the product. Mm. You have products out there today that are manufactured goods. Think of an elevator in an office building, where, yes, a manufacturer makes the elevator, but the manufacturer isn't making much money off of selling the elevator. The manufacturer's real interest is in having the 10-year maintenance contract that comes along with selling the elevator. In other words, with providing services in addition to this manufactured product.
Absolutely. Like so, printers today, it's really about the ink supply that they want for the next 10 years. What about the notion, and I was startled to read in your book, that world trade in manufactured goods, now you say that it has crested, but it rose 120% in the 7 years from 2001 to 2008. And yet disgruntlement with globalization seemed to be growing just around that time. What was going on there?
With a figure like that, 120% over 7 years, okay, that means that a lot of products that used to be made in one place maybe are now coming from another place. Okay, you had factories closing up, particularly in high-income countries, but also in some low-income countries. You had new factories opening elsewhere. A lot of people were displaced. Jobs vanished. Communities that had relied on particular industries, think of furniture making or aluminum products manufacturing or something like that, it was not uncommon to have those clustered, right? So you'd have a community that had a number of different factories that made products in that area. And in some cases, all of those factories closed up as the entire industry in the United States or in France or in Japan simply went away and was created anew in Mexico or in China or in some other place. So, you can't blame people for being upset by this. And I think, in general, there's been a rather flip attitude towards this. Yeah, it's good for the world. It is good for the world overall, but there are a lot of people who lose, and the equation doesn't work to say, well, I won and you lost, but what I won is more than what you lost, so the world wins. I don't think that's right. So there were definitely a lot of people who were badly hurt by this development in globalization, and especially by the speed with which it occurred.
Free trade, we talk about free trade. Number one, is free trade really meant to create jobs? Because I think in America, when we looked at the old NAFTA, that was the frustration about it. Did it really create jobs here or in Mexico? Then, of course, the anti-immigrant rage that has grown in America since. And then there's the issue of whether free trade is really free or whether, in fact, governments just are using political ends like tariffs or subsidies in one way or another to advantage their own industries.
Well, trade is really important to economic growth, okay? Trade does tend to force companies to be more efficient. The less efficient companies can't handle the competition from international trade. They get weeded out. One thing that trade does, politicians don't like to talk about, is it drives bad companies out of business. Okay, you've got companies that are doing the old thing, the old way with the old methods. They can't compete anymore. And this competitive pressure from international trade is in general a good thing for the world economy. What's happened, though, is that subsidies have reached such a high level that a lot of business decisions are being made that have nothing to do with efficiency, that have nothing to do with the underlying productivity differences. We have companies being paid large amounts in many cases to put a factory here rather than there. We have huge subsidies going into the construction of ships so that it's cheaper to send, it's cheaper for a ship line to buy a vessel in many cases than the actual cost of building that vessel. And so the users pay less than the true cost of transportation. And what that means is that you do have, in some cases, goods flowing from one place to another, not for reasons of comparative advantage, not because one place is more productive or more efficient relative to in making these goods relative to the other things it does, but rather because of the hand of a government has been on the scale, as I write in the book. I think one example of this, and it's by no means the only one, for a while in the 1990s and early 2000s, Costa Rica, of all places, became a major production center for semiconductors. Okay? It's hard to find what Costa Rica's competitive advantage was. Okay, it didn't have a workforce of skilled electricians. It didn't have any logistical infrastructure for semiconductors. It didn't have real estate sitting waiting to be used for this purpose. Okay. Its competitive advantage was created when Intel Corporation decided it wanted to make semiconductors in Costa Rica. And you can see that around the world in hundreds and hundreds of cases where business decisions are made for reasons that really don't have much to do with the underlying economics.
For example, I know that the weakness in our supply chain related to pharmaceuticals has certainly come into play during this COVID-19 pandemic. And just the other day, President Trump mentioned that he is going to help to restart the pharmaceutical manufacturing industry in Puerto Rico, where it had a major impact. And then because various benefits were taken away, Puerto Rico doesn't have that particular industry any longer. Is that another example of what you're talking about?
The pharmaceutical industry was in Puerto Rico because there was a tax advantage for companies to be in Puerto Rico rather than doing the same work, say, on the U.S. mainland. When that tax advantage went away, then they found it less interesting to be in Puerto Rico. A lot of pharmaceutical manufacturing is now in parts of China or India. And again, much of that is there for reasons of taxation. You shouldn't forget also that one of the great subsidies to globalization is tax avoidance. If you're a pharmaceutical manufacturer, so much of the value that your company generates is in licenses, patents, intellectual property. And you can move that stuff around the world. So if it's more advantageous to hold your patents in Ireland or Switzerland or wherever, you do that. And so you can avoid paying taxes, whereas a smaller company that's only in one country can't do that.
Mark Levinson is with us. He is the author of Outside the Box, How Globalization Changed Moving Stuff to Spreading Ideas. And Mark, the notion of a headquarters, and it's important. In our thinking, of course, we think about all the great American companies, and then we wonder why, in fact, they have decided to chase cheap labor and lower-cost countries. You say that some of those trends, because of reliability of supply chains, are changing, but does it really benefit a state, well, or a state within the United States or America itself, to have all these major corporations if much of their activity is being done elsewhere?
Well, this is a conundrum. Everyone, states, countries, is attempting to capture the value in these value chains. Okay, you would like as much of the work as possible done within your jurisdiction. You would like as many of the jobs as possible within your jurisdiction. And so your city or your county or your state or your country encourages that. But it can be very expensive to get these kinds of benefits because the corporations have a great deal of choice and a great deal of ability to move the location of their not only production, but their research, their back office work, even some of their front office work. So there are no sure bets anymore. A very large share now of major corporations' decisions are determined by who gives them breaks or subsidies.
And do various regimes, I mean, we think about China and some of their state-owned industries as really being advantaged versus many American companies that we say, well, they're out on their own because of the way we conduct business. So is there a major difference between democracies on the whole and those that are more top-down in terms of their governmental structure?
You know, it's really hard to figure out the extent to which you've got government policies benefiting one company as opposed to another. So in China, the subsidies are pretty huge. We have subsidies in the United States that take different forms. And so it's pretty hard to do a one-for-one comparison by any stretch. In the United States, the federal government typically doesn't give cash grants to corporations to build factories or to locate warehouses or whatever, but states and cities often do. Okay, so there's a lot of subsidy at that level. Government contracts are an important source of advantage to companies. So the United States has a much bigger government than many countries. As you might expect, we have a huge defense establishment that buys a lot of technology products, for example. That turns out to be a way to effectively channel subsidies to certain kinds of companies. So when you actually go through it and put the United States or some other country up against China or Japan or whatever, it can be hard to figure out who's paying the most, but I don't think there's anybody who really has clean hands here. There's not too many cases of the market working without government intervention.
Now, we know that the administration has said we really do not want to see the trade deficit as large as it is in the United States. But then others might point out, well, I have a trade deficit with my dentist. He doesn't give me anything, and I keep giving him money, but he's giving me something in return. I'd love your definition of a trade deficit and its significance economically.
Trade deficits have been less and less meaningful over time. The public still pays a lot of attention to them, but they don't really tell you very much anymore. Trade deficits work in concept when you've got a physical product and the value of that product is in the actual work to make it, and the stamping and in the molding and in the assembling and all of that. But that's really not what's going on here. I think people have probably read about a case such as the iPhone that's made assembled in China, and yet China gets only a very small share of the value of that iPhone. Most of the value actually comes from Japan and the United States. And so the fact that China has a big trade surplus in iPhones doesn't really tell you much about the state of the world. So much of the value in modern manufactured goods is in the services inputs, and it's very hard to figure out where they are made, where the value is added, and how that should be calculated in figuring out the trade deficit. Think of a modern corporation that might have research centers in 3 or 4 or 5 different countries and hire consultants in a bunch of different other countries to design a new product. Okay, so here you've got some of the work done in one country and it's sent electronically to another country where more of the work is done, and then a consultant from this other country writes some of the software. How do we figure out who made that? How much of that value is actually added in this country or that country? The company doesn't care, and the people who keep the statistics have no way of knowing. So we can't really do a very good job of finding out what the flow of trade here is. So that really makes this notion of a trade balance not very meaningful.
The reimposition of tariffs recently against China, and then ultimately a phase one agreement with China, do you feel that really did push it? Do you think America got a better deal? Because today, clearly, the two economic giants in the world are the U.S. and China. So put that in perspective for us.
Well, my perspective here is that we have seen global supply chains, global value chains, starting to retract long before we had this dispute with China and the United States, and as I say, long before Brexit and those sorts of things. Businesses are moving in this direction already because they've had some problems with supply chains, with value chains, and this has to do largely with misjudging risk. A lot of businesses, I'm talking about manufacturers and retailers, built their value chains around production costs and transportation costs. Okay, the bean counters ran the numbers and said, it's so much cheaper to make one unit of this product here than there, and it costs this much to put it on a ship and transport it, and so we're going to move our production from here to there. They didn't calculate in the possibility that this supply chain might be interrupted. And what we've seen is that value chain problems are frequent. Okay, there are many cases that arise when, for whatever reason, the goods don't get delivered on time. Okay, there can be an earthquake, or a fire, or a labor dispute, or any number of other problems that can lead to the interruption of a value chain. And this can be extraordinarily expensive for the companies concerned. This can mean that a retailer doesn't have its goods on the shelf in time for the Christmas season. This can mean that a manufacturer has to close a plant in one country because critical components made in another country aren't getting there. And so we've seen manufacturers and retailers step back a little bit from globalization. They have tried to diversify their supply chains. They've tried to make them more redundant so that if, for example, there's a strike at this port, they can use another port. And all of these things tend to take us a bit away from globalization. These are reasons that trade has been growing more slowly. And this is why I say that trade in the future is likely to grow more in the area of services and ideas than in the area of goods.
And I do want to get to that in closing, but you also talk about globalization turning more toward regionalization. Hubs like Germany in Europe, China in Asia, and the United States. So, for example, the new NAFTA, where we're working in concert with Canada and Mexico, and we could look at a lot of suppliers in Central and South America, much closer to home. With COVID-19, has that added to the impetus to do more regionalization than more broader globalization across the entire globe?
COVID-19 has drawn a lot of attention to supply chain vulnerabilities that businesses were thinking about before but may not necessarily have acted on before, and I think our government officials in general were not as conscious of before. So it has encouraged an investment in redundancy. What does that mean? Well, it means that whatever it is you make, you don't want to make it in one factory. Okay, perhaps you have the world's biggest factory over in China and you're making this good at the lowest possible unit cost because the factory is so huge. Well, maybe that's actually not a good idea, and you should pay more to have another factory someplace else to handle part of your production. You should be getting components from different places flowing into those factories, and you should have those components going by different routings. And you should have the finished product coming to the United States or wherever your customers are in different ways so that they're not all subject to the same risks. COVID-19 has really drawn attention to this question of supply chain resiliency. And I think it is just reinforcing this broader trend of not putting all your eggs in one basket.
Multilateral agreements for trade and exchange, starting, of course, with GATT, to the World Trade Organization, many discussions going on about how that particular organization gets changed over time and gets reformed. And then, of course, we've got a lot of these bilateral agreements that are ongoing between every sort of nation and every kind of arrangement. Is there any trend in that particular sphere?
The World Trade Organization has, I believe at this point, 161 members, if I remember correctly. Well, think about getting 161 of your closest friends around the table and trying to discuss what you want to order for dinner. Okay? This isn't going to happen. Okay? It's just not possible to reach agreements on very many subjects with so many interested parties. And one doesn't need to speak ill of any country to understand what the problem is there. So I think as a result of that, a lot of countries are going to these smaller deals where two countries strike an agreement, and it can cover whatever they want to cover, from trade in a particular industry to everything related to trade and investment and finance between those countries. The problem with these is, of course, is that they can lead to some decisions that are really inefficient. A firm has to put a plant here or there simply to take advantage of this special agreement. There's no other reason for that. And it can be very difficult for businesses to navigate because this country has this kind of special agreement with one trading partner, but it's special agreement with another trading partner is different, and so the product you're making may not fit under that other special agreement. So, you know, this is not an ideal situation, but as a practical matter, I think that governments are going with what they can achieve, and it's just been very difficult to achieve anything with 161 countries around the table.
In the latter portion of your book, you look at the next wave, and that's what this podcast focuses on. You see stuff, the stuff that you talked about getting moved in those containers in the box, losing ground to services. Explain what that looks like and what that means to America.
Sure. I think there are really three reasons why stuff is becoming less important in the world economy and in globalization. One is that we've got a significant demographic change. If you didn't notice personally, well, we're getting older. And the world population is getting older. And an older world population doesn't consume as much. There are many countries now where more than half the population is above age 40. When you're getting into these older age groups, you've already got your clothes. You probably don't buy as many. You've already got your house furnished. You don't need as much furniture. What do you spend money on? You may well be spending money on trips, vacations, healthcare, restaurant meals, other kinds of services. So that by itself, I think, is putting somewhat of a damper on the consumption of the kinds of goods that move in shipping containers. The second thing is that we've been seeing pretty interesting changes in manufacturing in a technological sense, so that it's not so labor intensive anymore. A lot of things can be produced in a much more automated fashion. You don't then need to have your factory in a low-wage country. Okay, you can put your factory near where your customers are rather than where workers are cheap. And I think we're seeing a lot of that. The third force that's underway is that manufactured goods are increasingly turning into services themselves. I remember back when I went to college, I took with me a record player and a box of records. And it's not that recent that there was a significant trade in stereo systems, right, and CDs. Well, these days music is a service. You don't need a special piece of equipment to play the music. You don't need to purchase the music in physical form. Music doesn't need to be traded. Cars are not yet a service, but they're moving in that direction. We have the auto manufacturers making big bets on the future of car sharing. Here the idea is that rather than owning a new car which spends most of its time parked, you would use a car when you need one and only pay for it then. Mm-hmm. Yes, you have a manufactured product, but you don't need as many cars around if people are sharing them effectively. So all of those things, I think, are going to suppress the demand for manufactured goods, and they will tend to strengthen the demand for services. That's where I think the world economy is going, and I think globalization is very much going in that direction.
Very interesting. And the book has so much more about the history of globalization. So if you have had your appetite whetted during the course of this conversation, go find it, Mark Levinson. Outside the Box, How Globalization Changed Moving Stuff to Spreading Ideas. Thank you for spreading some ideas around today on America Trends.
Thanks for having me. It's been great to be with you.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.